WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. Milt Bearden's resume reads like a tour through the Cold War. He was a CIA operative in China at the end of the Cultural Revolution. He later ran interference with KGB counterparts as a station chief in Pakistan and Khartoum. And in the mid-80s, he directed the agency's covert aid program to Afghan rebels during the Soviet invasion. After 30 years in intelligence, Bearden retired and took up writing. His spy novel Black Tulip is based on his time in Afghanistan, delivering arms and military training to the Mujahideen. Bearden says that the war between the Mujahideen and the Soviets was at a stalemate until the U.S. equipped the Afghan rebels with Stinger anti-aircraft missiles. I asked him to describe the Stinger.
Well, it's a shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missile that the reality is it's super sophisticated, but it's what you would call a fire-and-forget weapon. All you have to do is follow some fairly simple instructions and do what you've been taught, which could last a few days or a week or not much more than that. And if an aircraft is within about 10,000 feet of you, you're likely to be able to bring him down, and that's a helicopter or a fast-moving fighter aircraft. And the description of the first Stinger shoot down in the Black Tulip is, you know, word for word, the way it happened. It's just exactly an account of the way this engineer and his team were out on a 100-killer mission in Jalalabad, or outside Jalalabad, and brought down the first three helicopters in September 26, 1986, and turned the war around.
Now, part of your responsibilities, aside from funneling in weaponry to the tune of about over $1 billion into Afghanistan, was overseeing the covert aid program for Afghan rebels fighting the Soviets and to provide military training to them. What kind of military instruction did the CIA impart to the guerrillas?
Well, the CIA was only indirectly involved in most of the training. I think it's overdone. This is a very good area to get into on this whole thing. Training, certainly on the sophisticated weapon systems like the Stinger, was choreographed by the U.S., and that was carried out over the next 3 years of the war. The rest of the training was pretty much small arms and crew-served weapons. The question you raise is the blowback issue, and it's a good one, and I don't usually shy away from it. So here is my take on that. We had the Soviet Union invade Afghanistan on Christmas Eve in 1979, and we had a very good man, a moral man, as president at the time, Jimmy Carter, who said, you know, this cannot stand. So he made the decision to go in and do something about it, and he, rather than reacting with his Defense Department or just sending diplomatic notes of protest, decided to take the third alternative, which is to put CIA onto the thing. And the mission was always the same. It never changed. It was to stop the Soviets, turn them around, and make them leave Afghanistan. By the time I got there, about 50% of the Afghan population had been killed, wounded, or exiled into awful, squalid refugee status by the Soviets. So I think that what we did was proper. It was needed, and it was reasonably well executed. My problems start to arise where everybody else's do, and that's after the Soviets quit Afghanistan in 1989. Then what?
So you're saying that the CIA was not involved in training the Mujahideen in any terrorist tactics?
Correct, but let's take a look at this realistically. The terrorist business is often murky. My freedom fighter could be your terrorist. But we had a lot of rules going in our engagement in Afghanistan. They begin with little things like anti-personnel mines. The United States government, CIA, said, we're not going to do that. We're not going to buy any. We're not going to distribute any. We're not going to use any, because the truth about those mines is that they'll be blowing off the legs of young boys and girls tending goats for the next 50 years. They don't help you that much, so we won't do that. On terrorism, we did not train the Afghans to commit acts of terrorism. We obviously trained them to conduct military operations. But, for example, I spent considerable energy in my role as political agent in that part of the world, telling the Mujahideen that there were no percentages, no real advantages in doing things like car bombs or truck bombs. They have a lot of collateral damage. And so the truth is that there wasn't a lot of terrorism if you look at it objectively. The Soviet embassy in Kabul never got blown up. The Soviet embassy in Islamabad, just across the border into Pakistan, never got blown up. I don't think we can go back to a single act of Afghan terrorism during that entire war.
Let's talk about Osama bin Laden. When did he first appear on the agency radar as a major player in the anti-Soviet insurgents?
We knew he was there. He was one of a large number of Gulf Arabs that had shown up for this jihad. It was their jihad. It was, we wanted a piece of it because of, A, it was the right thing to do, and B, the Soviet Union was involved. But these fundraisers and they included not only bin Laden, but Saudi Red Crescent and all kinds of other groups, some of them very, very good and proper, and others, a little on the psychopathic side, contributed a lot of money to that effort. They built a lot of refugee camps and homes for orphans of the fallen Mujahideen and their widows as well. And in fact, all the way up till the withdrawal of the Soviets, bin Laden would have been thought of more of as a Robin Hood type character than any kind of a problem. We didn't have any contact with them, and for good reason, because none was needed. And so a lot of the speculation and stories that Osama bin Laden was our guy and that we recruited Arabs and trained them and all this for the jihad, that's just not true, regardless of who says it.
What do you think of the United States and the Britain's obsession with pursuing the manhunt of Osama bin Laden? Are we making the same mistake again, the danger of demonizing him as this towering personality, as the mastermind of the World Trade Center and Pentagon attacks, as the figure?
I think we are. The Brits and the Americans are in pretty much lockstep here, so we really don't have much daylight between us. But I think both of us as cultures like to put a face and a name on our adversaries, and we do personalize. I mean, look at the Gulf War. This was something to where, I mean, we all heard our president say Saddam. How many times? Saddam Hussein, Saddam. We personalize these things. I think that can be, I guess, okay if it's a Saddam Hussein or a Hitler or something like that. But on something as poorly understood as this international terrorist thing, I believe it could be even dangerous to think that just by hauling Osama bin Laden onto the dock in a burlap bag and saying, this is it, there will be a sense that it's over after that.
What comes next for the CIA in this new war on terrorism? And you've described this new phase in the war as a Kipling's ageless game of treachery and betrayal. What does that game entail? And I suppose many people are questioning whether the CIA is up to it as it stands now.
We're still talking about Afghanistan, that's the Kipling's ageless game of treachery and betrayal, and they brought a lot of people back in who had who had had the experience over there, and sometimes it may have looked like Dad's army or Granddad's army of CIA guys working with U.S. Army Special Forces people in very small units. But when you look at what's happened over the last 100 days in Afghanistan, the inescapable conclusion is that the people who were doing this, who were managing this, understood it. Just when the Northern Alliance reached a point moving into Kabul that could have turned this thing upside down, they stopped. At the key point, all of a sudden, we heard a new term, Eastern Alliance. And you had special forces and CIA people in very small groups working with a lot of the old commanders in the East as they sought to move through Tora Bora and now through Paktia province. And the same thing was going on down in the South. None of this was an accident. This was, I think, a very well thought out game book, a playbook for how to do this thing without making all of the big mistakes that one makes.
I'm talking with Milt Bearden. He is a 30-year veteran of the CIA. He ran the CIA's covert aid program to Afghan rebels fighting the Soviets in the 80s. He served as a station chief in Pakistan and Khartoum for the agency. Bearden's the author also of a novel about the war in Afghanistan called Black Tulip. We're going to take a break now, Milt, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with CIA veteran Milt Bearden. He ran the agency's covert operations in Afghanistan during the Soviet-Afghan War. He's the author of a novel of war in Afghanistan called Black Tulip. If we could pull back right now and take a global look at global terrorism, during your tenure in the CIA, the Cold War was the rationale for everything. It was the backdrop for almost every move you made there, for better or for worse. Can you contrast that with the situation now, what it means for Central Intelligence not to have an overriding ideology or historical context on which to base its operations in this fight against loosely affiliated global terrorism networks?
I mean, you've really got it. I mean, that's, that's tough. I mean, I joined the CIA in 1964 after the organization was 15, 16, 17 years old. But the agency was formed by the National Security Act of 1947, and that alone tells you what it was all about. I mean, it tells you that basically this is a thing that was pulled together by Harry Truman because the Soviet thing bothered him a lot. And everything that was done by the CIA up until Boxing Day in 1991, when the Soviet Union disappeared, had some tentacle reaching in to make it part of that great big picture of the Soviet Union, whether it was Afghanistan or Central America or the gamesmanship in Africa. You're right. You've got it exactly right, centered around this perfect enemy that had made a world that was very, very orderly when you think about it. You had two powers. Now, the Soviets were perhaps overestimated, but you had a bipolar world. Most of the countries of the world lined up around one of those two poles, and there was no such thing as a failed state. That came after the Soviet Union disappeared from the scene, and we became the sole remaining superpower. And if you're, and so then some states became like, why bother to throw any money? The Soviets aren't going to pick these guys up, so leave them to their own devices. And we end up with the Afghanistans, the Somalias, and a few other countries.
I'm talking with CIA veteran Milt Bearden. He ran the agency's covert operations in Afghanistan during the Soviet-Afghan War. He's written a spy novel of war in Afghanistan. It's called Black Tulip. Now, what was your first assignment or skill that you had to develop where you said, oh, yeah, this is the cloak and dagger stuff I came here for?
Well, the first thing they do to you is you take off and go disappear somewhere that I don't think I'm still allowed to say, but you go through the school, the training, and you just learn all, in 1964 terms, it would probably be something that every kid has nowadays, but, you learn everything from locks and picks, how wonderful that is. I mean, you open open things that people don't want you to open, and flaps and seals, which is, you know, getting into mail and then doing all kinds of covert communications. But this is still at a time when CIA didn't have the computing power of the laptop computer that's probably, you know, on the desk in front of you right now. But we were learning the trade. We were absolutely convinced of who we as a nation were. Don't forget, it was only starting in 64, you know, the Tonkin Gulf resolution, and America was still feeling pretty good. The Kennedy thing had shaken us, but it had not rattled us. That would all come later. And so this was a wonderful time. I spent only a year doing the training thing, and then I was in Germany as a young CIA officer, because I had German as well as Chinese. And I was over there more or less as watching secondarily what the Chinese were up to in Europe. So I had Chinese and German kept me in German-speaking Europe for years and years.
Did you ever in your 30 years in the CIA have to pick a lock?
You know, I didn't. In my 30 years, no, in my 30 years, when I had to have a lock picked, there was always a guy that did that so much better than the guy that taught me how to do it. And in the interim period, after let's say the mid 70s, we didn't, you know, in the Frank Church period and all that. Those things were no longer thought of as cool, and so they didn't teach them anymore, except to people who would really, that would be what they would do, kind of second story guys.
Well, just to show how naive I am, I have to ask you this question, which is in the book, Black Tulip, you present an interesting mind game that the spy Alexander plays with the Soviet commanders and operatives in Afghanistan, and he leaves a note for them in the setup for an operation to blow up a Soviet ammunitions facility. And the note is designed to put the Soviets on edge, I suppose. Nothing's spelled out plainly. He signs the note, has someone sign the note with the name of one of the 99 names of Allah. And it's interpreted as a game by the Soviets, a very sophisticated one. He also sends a black tulip, the symbol of death, to the Soviets in Afghanistan. Does that kind of stuff really go on?
Oh, I did all of that stuff, yeah. I mean, but that's because I'm a hopeless romantic, and I think maybe not everybody does that way, but so much of the stuff in the black tulip is right out of the way. I did that war for 3 years. During the Afghan war, it developed that there were supposed to be toy bombs being put out there by the Soviets. These were ballyhooed all over the American media and on broadcast television as just another sign of how evil the Soviets were, to create bombs in the shape of toys so that little children would have their arms and legs blown off by them. Truth was, it wasn't true. There were some small mines that they were dropping from helicopters that looked like something a kid would pick up, and then in fact they did, and they got hurt. But the story drove the Soviets so nuts that I was asked often by Washington, "What do I think about it?" I said, "The story isn't true, but don't let that stop you from exploiting it." And so we really played them hard on that one. And I even sent to the KGB chief catalogs from Toys R Us. And I just, you know, I like to go through my life saying that turned it over for him. He finally just ran screaming out to the airport and said, "Get me out of here." I give you that one free because of a couple of the others I can't give you. But one of the things that haunts me to this day is this story that is still out there. And when I was in Moscow last time, some of the former Soviet troopers kind of got word to me that they still held a grudge on this event. I told you earlier that I had discouraged the use of car bombs and truck bombs because this would lose sympathy for the Mujahideen. And very proudly, one time I was advised that, "Mr. Milt, we have just done a very successful camel bomb operation. And they had taken a camel, loaded it with a bunch of explosives, and put it by a Soviet garrison in Jalalabad, where everybody knows where that is today, and detonated it, and it had taken out a lot of troops. And I had never told them to do a camel bomb, but they thought that since I didn't say don't do a camel bomb, that that would be okay. And this one still comes back at me. I mean, it's almost a bizarre, weird story of how these people say, well, we can't do car bombs and truck bombs because Mr. Milt says that's bad, but let's do a camel bomb and somehow that's going to be okay. So that one is still out there.
Milt Bearden, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today on Fresh Air.
Been terrific being with you.
Milt Bearden served as an intelligence officer in the CIA for 30 years. His spy novel, The Black Tulip, is out in paperback. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.